Blog Talk Radio.
Rising report, it's that Apple report. It's the rising Apple report. Rising report, it's that Apple report. It's the rising Apple report.
Yeah!
And good evening to my fellow Mets fans out there. This is Rising Apple staff writer Rich Virago, and you are listening to the 129th episode of the Rising Apple Report, and we're glad to have you. So joining me tonight are a couple of voices that you'll find very familiar to the Rising Apple Report, so let's just jump right in. First guest, one of my co-writers on the site, Mr. Mike LaColin. Mike, how are you this evening?
I'm doing well, sir, getting better by the day. Baseball is back, so things are well, things are good.
Great, and we have a guest joining us tonight, and this is another voice that is very, very familiar to the Rising Apple Report, and a voice and a person who is very familiar in the Mets blogosphere and to Mets fans in general, and we're thrilled to have her again tonight, and that is my friend Taryn the Coop Cooper. How are you tonight, Coop?
I'm doing great. It seems like we've had more off days than on days the beginning of the baseball season, but it's all good. I mean, we won't be complaining about games in the summertime, that's for sure.
That is for sure, and we're great to have you, and thanks for joining us, Coop. So I want to jump right in, and I want to do something that's a little bit different than the way we typically start these podcasts, and I guess because I'm the host, I have the right to do that, right? So here's where I want to start, and I'm going to throw it to you guys to comment. I'll start with Mike. And I want to start with this idea I've had lately. I used to be a Terry Collins supporter. I always said that you gave the man, you know, chicken shit and expected him to make chicken salad out of it. And I thought it was unfair and people would pick on him. But my opinion changed in the World Series. I really thought that what a lot of people said came home to roost and that the moment proved to be too big for Terry when he made the move to leave Harvey in Game 5, and we all know the reasons for that he stated. He stated that he let the player make the decision, which we all know is egregiously bad. And worse than that, he said 42,000 people were chanting, Harvey, Harvey, and he wanted to please the fans, essentially, which takes it to another level of bad. So, okay, but the Mets then give Terry Collins a contract to come back. And what does he say in the press conference that took place a day or two after the World Series ended? He says, well, I learned from that. I learned from that, and, you know, going forward, that won't happen again. So fast forward 5 months and about 10 days to a game that took place yesterday, April 13th, where the Mets are in their eighth game of the season. Yes, a win would have been very nice. They needed to win the game. It wasn't a must-win game. And Terry did some things that we can get into the individual moves, like throwing Jim Henderson out there after he had thrown 34 pitches the night before, bringing Familia back on for the third consecutive day when the first 2 days were in non-save situations. He managed the game almost like a bit like a crazy man, if you want my opinion. And when asked why he did that, he said, because I read the newspapers and I know what you guys say, and I didn't want you guys and our fans to think we weren't trying, that we weren't dedicated, we were taking things for granted, all of those things. As far as I'm concerned, he said he learned from Harvey. He didn't learn from Harvey. He did the same damn thing again on Wednesday. I think the moment is too big for this man, and I'm very concerned. I'm concerned that what a lot of people said, like I said before, Collins was the guy through the rebuilding phase, that's fine. But when the moment gets big, I now have absolutely no faith in this man. I hate to start out negatively. I'm done. Mike, your comments.
it's laughable. You know, I always try to take in mind what is said to the media necessarily isn't what you want to say or what you're thinking or what you feel. Sometimes you just feel like being snarky. I think part of that is what transpired. But, you know, that being said, Terry Collins, we know he's bullpen challenged. And he really needs to massage situations a little better. You know, overreacting in April to what took place, you know, back in October, wrong move. You need to handle it a little differently, you know, act a little bit more calm. Act like you've been there before. This is in your first season, you know, so to say things like that, to perform in such a hasty manner, with renewed and really heavy expectations placed on him and the club this season, Rich, you know what? You're onto something. You might be right. The moment, the situation perhaps grew and is still becoming too big for him. You know, I'm not exactly going to write that in stone, but you just might be onto something there, my friend.
Thanks, Mike. Okay, Coop, you're up.
Well, I mean, you guys know that I usually do provide the detracting opinion on the roundtable. And I guess Mets fans, and you know, this isn't a reflection on you guys because I know you guys are, like, really smart. You look at the team from a 360-degree view. You're able to look at many different ways. You know what? I've always been a Terry Collins fan. Most people know that I've been a huge supporter of him, because as Rich said, he really wasn't gifted with the best of teams, and he's had to make do with what he has and or the lack thereof. One of the positives I think that TC has is the ability to take the pressure off of his players. When they were sucking really bad last year, and then when he lost his mind in the post-game conference after the Wilmer Flores debacle, and what we thought when he got traded, and we had a show the day after, and that game was a mess. We always kind of look at that. You know, Terry has his moments with the media, but he's been able to kind of take the pressure off of himself as far as bullpen management. What manager manages a bullpen perfectly? Let's be fair. I mean, I remember watching Matt Williams kind of lose his mind in a game in September against the Mets, just over-managing the bullpen. And this is a team, by the way, the Nationals, that was supposed to run away with everything last year, and they didn't. And you know, the managers can lose a team. That's not, you know, unheard of. And we know that that's happened in Terry Collins' house as well. As far as what he said in the media about managing, like, games for the World Series, you know, is the pressure on it? Maybe. I mean, the team looked anemic. We have, you know, the ace, quote-unquote. We have Matt Harvey, who's, you know, having dead arm issues in freaking February. Why am I saying February? Hello. In freaking April, which is like February in the year, but whatever. He's having dead arm issues now. Jacob DeGrom, who has been clearly the most reliable starting pitcher that they've had the last 2 years, he's clearly not the same, lost velocity, whatever. Now, if we're going to go back to Game 5 of the World Series last year, bringing Harvey out, I'll defend that move. You keep the hot hand in there. You don't leave that game to the bullpen. But unfortunately, and if you look at that first batter, you know, there were some questionable pitches that could have easily been called strikes if they were called balls. So it could have gone either way. But I felt like after that first batter, Harvey should have been taken out. You know, but Terry didn't panic. CC did not panic. And, you know, it kind of snowballed from there. So, yes, he's going to have a lot of 2020 hindsight, a lot of armchair critics that are going to say, well, maybe he should have taken Harvey out. I will say, I would have kept Harvey in there, too, if I was the manager. That said, now he's managing like it's Game 7 of the World Series. I mean, yes, the team needed a win desperately. There were a lot of close games. Pitching is not the problem. We're back to square one, where we're just not clicking on all cylinders, we're not hitting. I do not think that is a reflection on TC at all. And if anything, he's once again taking the pressure off the team and putting the pressure on him. And I do not think that's a bad thing. I think that's what a manager should do. You know, people were saying last week that David Wright was dead. People were saying, you know, Yoenis Cespedes is a bust, you know, seven, and it wasn't me. I wasn't saying he was a bust, and you know that I tend to say that about certain players. But, you know, it was, you know, it's a bunch of, you know, Mets Twitter, you know, sky is falling kind of mentality, and then we've got the New York Rise that have nothing better to do than say, you know, the Mets are losing it, and they're, you know, they start the year 3-5, and OMG, and, you know, Ed is over here calculating magic numbers, and I'm like, everybody, relax. You know, it's not time to jump off the cliff. You know, if we have, you know, somebody choking, you know, Noah Syndergaard in the locker, or, you know, in the clubhouse, and Terry Collins doesn't know about it, then, yeah, maybe it's time to let him go. But I don't think it's, you know, I don't think it's time to be concerned about him yet. He's kind of showing us who he actually is. And nobody was complaining when the Mets were winning down the stretch last year about PC. So there's that. Except Mike Silva, maybe, but that's it.
Well, fair enough. And, you know, I've heard the argument that stay with a hot hand, Harvey was going down. So with that said, let's, you know, we kind of danced around Harvey. Let's go to Matt Harvey now. So Harvey's had two starts so far this season. And neither has been bad. Neither has been particularly good. So I'd like to get your thoughts on Harvey. You know, is it too early to say, you know, he's only had a couple of starts, what the heck? Or are you at all concerned by the start that Matt Harvey has had? And, can we let that word creep into our vernacular? Can we let the word overrated when talking about Matt Harvey creep into our vernacular? Coop, why don't you take that one to start?
Okay. I'll be happy to, actually. Talking about Matt Harvey, you know, I usually have – and I know that this is no way to kind of be an analytical baseball fan. And you know that I can provide analysis. I can provide numbers to back up my stats. But sometimes something just seems a little bit off. And coming into the season, seeing him, you know, in spring training struggling, the quote-unquote dead arm issues and whatnot, I don't know if Matt Harvey is necessarily overrated, but I will say I do not think on paper or even performance-wise he is anywhere near the best pitcher on the staff. Now, that's not to say he wouldn't be an ace anywhere else. I have a friend on social media. Her name is Andrea Mala. She does sports astrology. Okay, so, you know, keep your laughter to yourself if you're not really into moves and futures. But I find the topic very fascinating, and we struck up a friendship on Twitter and Facebook and whatnot. And she just said, you know, I'm really concerned about Harvey and DeGrom, and this is before they started having injuries. And I'm like, you know, I said, Noah Syndergaard, to me, like, this is the year of four. So, but, you know, on the flip side, I have in the back of my head that, you know, something's got to give, you know. But I also felt like out of, you know, it was always Harvey versus Wheeler, like kind of like this Tiffany versus Debbie Gibson kind of rivalry thing going on, where I feel like Zach Wheeler is the one with higher upside. So while he was in trade rumors and we were kind of like, oh, my gosh, we're going to let him go, and we were kind of justifying it, well, pitching is actually a strength. We can kind of let him go. Part of me is like, he is going to be such a phenomenal pitcher. I really am feeling greedy. I want him too. So going back to Harvey, is it too early to be concerned? Maybe. I mean, he started off against the Royals. You know, the Royals might have just had his number because they faced him in, you know, their last game last year. It's not out of the realm of possibility that they, you know, that they know what to look for. You know, if he's tipping any of his pitches, whatever. And then we're going to another game. And, you know, teams are they starting to figure out? I don't know. But that said, you know, I would say by his third start, if he hasn't gotten his shit together and we're still hearing dead arm, dead arm, dead arm, now might be the time to be like, hey, Matt, WTF, what's going on here? I don't think it's, you know, if he'll get himself out of it. But, you know, he came out of the gate last year after, you know, Tommy John surgery being off, you know, well over a year in, you know, season-wise. it just seems to me like there's some kind of disconnect with the conditioning with him and Jacob deGrom so early in the season. That, to me, is concerning, mostly, not just Harvey. Overrated, you know what, if the Yankees still want him when his contract's up, let him have him.
Well, fair enough on that. And it's a little harsh to judge a guy after two starts because, remember, three starts ago, he was great against the Royals until the ninth inning. So, but we have expectations, and that's part of it, Matt. You know, that's part of it. You want to be the guy, you have to be the guy. And New York fans and fans in general, part of being a fan is you're implicitly impatient. And we are impatient. And we see him go out there and look human. He doesn't even look bad. He just looks human. It makes us wonder, and especially, like you said, Coop, when you're butting him up against the likes of Thor and DeGrom and Wheeler coming back, you know, you start to wonder if Harvey maybe isn't living up to those expectations. So, Mike, what are your thoughts on the Dark Knight?
You threw out an interesting word, which 99.9% of the time I would agree 100% with you on. Impatient. Yeah, New Yorkers, Met fans generally are impatient. But in this particular situation, as it pertains to Matt Harvey, I think we're real resistant to the thought that the Dark Knight is vulnerable. I think as fans, we're kind of in that no man's land where we're afraid to think the worst. And right now, we're still clinging to what we hope is, you know, the best is still yet to come. He's showing signs of, quote-unquote mortality, and that's an injection of anxiety. So I think I'm saying the same thing as you guys, just a different way.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, he doesn't look – maybe it's unfair. You know, maybe because of who we thought he was going to be, we have an image in our mind that he'll throw every game like Thor threw on Tuesday night. And that's not fair. It's not realistic. But it's real. You know, it's what we are. It's what we do. And when he goes out there and looks more like, you know, looks more like a number three starter on somebody's staff, and we said, hold on a minute, you're not living up to the image we created. That's really not your fault. It's more our fault. But anyway, you're not living up to this image that we have of you. You're underachieving. You know, you're overrated. So maybe it's not fair, but it's definitely the sentiment that's out there with regard to Harvey. And now that we're talking about Matt Harvey, I think it's a good time to bring on our favorite caller, a gentleman, a young man we call Long Island Mike, who has been in the queue for about 15 minutes. Long Island Mike, how are you doing tonight?
Good, you?
Good, and I know you probably have something you might want to say about Matt Harvey, so why don't you go with it?
Yeah, I said we should have traded him last offseason. Well, I guess you can call it the previous offseason we just had. I say we should have traded him. I've been saying that because he's going to have a bad season this year. I predicted it from the get-go. And when we will trade him in this coming offseason, the value of him having a bad season will hurt us and what we get for return.
So, you know, it's so funny how the mighty have fallen with regard to Harvey. And now that we're talking about pitchers, let's go to a couple more guys. And Mike, we'll start with you on this one. Steven Matz went out there Monday night, and he did not look good. And okay, you know, it's another thing where a guy has a bad start. But my question to you and my question to Coop and Long Island Mike will be, with regard to Steven Matz, here's a guy who has all the potential in the world. You have a lefty who's throwing in the mid-90s, you know, good secondary pitches, but he's had a tough time staying on the mound. He's been hurt a lot. And he clearly, you know, is at least a length behind the other guys in the rotation. So when you see Steven Matz, Mike, go out there and basically lay an egg like he did on Monday night, are you concerned about Steven Matz given his injury history and all that stuff, or do you say this is just a young guy and let's ride him, he's going to be just as good as the rest?
I'm not concerned per se. That said, I still think he could use some time under the influence of Frank Viola. I think that more than anything. He just needs to learn his craft a little bit better. His kids need to learn how to pitch under adversity a little bit better. They need to know how to rely on a plan B. and things of that nature. Yeah, as you say, he's a talented kid, bright kid, you know, and he's got a lot going for him. But, you know, you need to learn your craft and learn how to pitch under adverse conditions. And, you know, things tend to go kaplooey for the unprepared, you know. So maybe a little bit more mental preparation, a little bit more tutelage under Frank Viola at Las Vegas would serve him very well, because Dan Worland has his hands full, you know, with the rest of the staff. And well, let's call it for what it is. That's Frank Viola's job. So that would require a transaction. But that's where I think his mind is at. I think he just needs a little bit more understanding into the nature of what he does for a living.
Coop, your thoughts on Steven Matz?
All right. Well, his schedule was all thrown off. I mean, I think in the first week, I mean, I wasn't expecting him to get bombed the way that he did. But, you know, what he was doing, you know, the few starts that he has had, because he did have some, you know, injury issues. You know, Dr. Jeff Ramirez probably touched him wrong, and, you know, his arm almost fell off again. But last year, you know, let's face it, the pace that he was at was kind of unsustainable. He was kind of due for a start like this. I think he'll level out. I have, like, no concern about Matt. Yeah, it sucks. But, you know, he's going to have to put his big boy pants on someday and deal with it anyway. So I really feel like this, even Matt, was just a non-issue signing thing. Everybody's schedule is off. That's something else I didn't bring up about Matt Harvey, is that, you know, he's all about the timing. He's all about the schedule and throwing on his, you know, given day and blah, blah, blah. You know, there's probably a mental aspect and there's definitely a physical aspect. You know, Matt gets bombed in this next term, be like, hey, what's going on here? But I don't think he will. He'll be fine. Mets are fine.
I like the optimism. Long Island Mike, what do you think about your fellow Long Islander, Steven Matz?
I'm a fan of Steven Matz. He was on rest for 10 days. And the last time he pitched in spring training, he won. He was
6 no-hit.
Getting it again.
The Cubs, right? So I don't want to hear that he sucks. He has potential
to be better than Matt Harvey.
If he can locate a secondary.
He does have a world of potential, and that's the thing about Matz, is, and that's what keeps me juiced about him, is, you know, he doesn't get nearly, for obvious reasons, nearly the amount of airplay and the amount of kudos as do his fellow rotation mates, but the kid is really special, and he can be something special. And Mike, you raised a point I'm still thinking about. Seeing that Logan Verrett did a really nice job yesterday, and they have Montero up at the big club. Maybe you've hit on something. You know, maybe a little more time with Frank Viola could help this kid out. And I hadn't really thought about that, but when you think about it, if he took 2 or 3 starts down in Vegas and you kind of, you know, plugged in with Logan Verrett or Montero, maybe let Viola work with this kid a little bit. And maybe that's not a half bad idea. I really like that idea.
The thing about that real quick is you've heard Sandy Alderson stress that, you know, philosophically what the Mets teach takes place at the A+, AA level. When they hit Frank Viola, now that's when that injection of major league influence takes place. And I think that's all that's really needed. As you say, he's a talented kid, and I agree with that wholeheartedly. It's just a matter of him understanding baseball at the major league level. That's all. I think it's a minor tinker job, and it's really mental, and he just needs to get illuminated on certain aspects of his craft.
Yeah, no, I hadn't thought about that, but I think given the depth of the rotation and where we are in the season, it might not be a bad move to give him a couple of starts down in Vegas to let him, you know, get on a regular rhythm, let him get his head right, let Viola be a part of that, and bring him back for what we all hope will be a fun summer. So very interesting point on that. And now we'll get to the part of our show where we get happy and we start talking about happy things, at least for the moment. Anyway. Yeah, as Met fans, we can't be happy for an hour, so we have to be happy for a moment.
Nah.
So, Coop, I'm going to go to you first on this one, but I'd like to talk about probably my favorite Met, and that is Thor. I mean, this guy, not only is he pitching to about a 0.54 ERA after two starts, which is just phenomenal, and the way he was so dominant on Tuesday night, and beyond that, how about that start against the Royals when he got out of that bases loaded, no out situation? And what doesn't this kid do? You know, he's subtle enough, yet he's funny. You know, he and that's part of why he's funny, because he's sort of shy and awkward. He rides it on the horse with Cespedes. He's very active on social media. And he goes out there, and he's a great pitcher on top of it all. So I'm a huge Thor fan. He's gotten off to a great start. Coop, why don't you run with Thor? What are your thoughts on Thor?
Thor is special. And mark my words, he's already a Met cult figure. And Met fans love their cult guys. I mean, look at Bartolo Colon. Or even somebody like R.A. Dickey. These are not just pitchers, because Met fans love their pitchers. These are Mets that, you know, to quote Jason Fry, if they didn't exist, Met fans would have made them up to be just these, you know, phenomenal people. You know, it's almost, Thor's almost got like a Sid Finch quality that is like, it can't be that good. You know, but here's something that I noticed, and you say, like, he rode in on the horse with Yoenis Cespedes. Well, he also got his whole family to pose at Christmas time wearing big sexy shirts with Bartolo Colon's likeness on it. This guy isn't just a rock star, you know, pitcher and ball player. He is a showbiz guy. And this is something, you know, I know that some of you guys are Steely Dan fans. They're showbiz kids. That's why, you know, the Mets kind of took everything over last year. It wasn't that they were, you know, at the end of the day, you know, they won 90 games. That's nothing to shake a stick at. That wasn't the best record. They didn't, you know, they ran away with the division. They didn't run away to the World Series. We were all waiting for the other shoe to drop. What people focused on, Jacob DeGrom's long hair, his flowing locks. Thor, look at this kid. He's like this scrawny, tall guy with long hair, and he calls himself Thor, and he just puts himself out there. Like you say, he's like this shy, awkward, geeky kid. He's almost like Garth Algar in Wayne's World, kind of like playing the drums, and he's like, thank you, I like to play. Like, I mean, Thor is somebody, like, when you were talking about him, yeah, you know what, Mets fans need to be miserable sometimes, but you can't help but smile when you think about Noah Syndergaard. He is awesome. And what I really like is that people still underestimate him. That's what I love about it. I love that. I'm like, you know what? Keep underestimating him. Underestimate him all the way to the Cy Young. Underestimate him all the way to Game 7 of the World Series where he's rushing, you know, the batters back. Who cares? Let's get him.
He is truly something special because, you know, he has the personality that's just right. You know what I mean? He's not so in your face. He doesn't make statements like Harvey makes about most women would be jealous of my shoe collection. He doesn't do stuff like that. He's just under the radar enough personality-wise that you want to like him, and you do like him. Because Harvey gives you something not to like. Thor doesn't do that. And it's just, and I forgot about the big sexy thing with the family. How funny was that?
Oh, that was hilarious. I was like, can I be adopted into the Syndergaard family? And I'm like, we're going to get that shirt.
I know. It's just, it's part of what makes us, the rare thing that makes us all smile collectively as Met fans, and Thor's certainly one of them. So, Mike, what are your thoughts on Noah?
I got it on a good source that he's not human. NASA has to so that might explain a lot. No, this guy, as you both say, he's bordering near perfect. There's nothing outstanding that you can point at and say, that's negative. Let's go after it. No, there's nothing there. Personality-wise, performance-wise, so far, brilliant. He's not overstated, but yet he speaks his mind very clearly. You know exactly where he stands. But he doesn't do it in you know, a pompous manner or anything of the kind. So, yeah, very softly, but very clearly and effectively well spoken for. Just,
it's otherworldly. That's why. He can't be from this planet. Nobody's that perfect. Come on.
Agreed, you know. And all right, Long Island Mike, I know, so we know now that you're not a huge Harvey fan. We know you are a Mats fan. Where do you come down on Thor?
Love him. Like Mike
Good.
Said, he's not human. People react to a 95-mile-per-hour slider and be like, that was a slider? That's a fastball for most guys. So, yeah, he's not human. I want to test him for, like, is there, like, a test for not being human or something? But he's something. He's the next Clayton Kershaw.
He may be, you know, and I was watching the Yankee game last night, and they were talking about the trade that the Mets got Syndergaard in, and, you know, and I think exactly what they said, and they rarely compliment the Mets. They said, while Dickey has been decent for the Blue Jays, my God, what did the Mets get in return? I mean, this guy is just – all we could do is hope that he stays healthy and that he just continues doing what he's doing, both personality-wise, doesn't get too big for his britches, as my mother would say, and he stays focused and just keeps entertaining us for years to come. And I believe he doesn't become a free agent until 2022, I believe. So we don't even have to worry about that nonsense for a while. It might be 2020. We don't have to worry about that for a while either. So it's all good with Thor. Now let's turn. We've talked a lot about the pitching staff. Time to talk about something a little less pleasant, and that would be the Mets offense. You know, I mean, it looks a lot like late June, early July of last year. I think we've all made those analogies. You know, the Cubs series of late June, early July, where the Mets scored, I believe, one run in three games. They've been a little better than that, but not much. You know, seven hits one night, four hits another night. And, you know, Mike, I'll go to you first on this one, but here's my thought on it. I'm very interested to hear all three of your thoughts. You reap what you sow, and the Mets and Sandy has this philosophy that he who hits the most home runs wins, and statistically that does bear out. However, when you have an offense predicated on the long ball and you're not hitting the long ball because you're in a slump, you don't have anywhere else to turn. You know, this team is not meant to manufacture runs. They don't hit and run. They don't steal bases. And when you get into one of these collective slumps, there's just nowhere to go. And so it rankles me quite a bit that we find ourselves in this situation every year where they go into this collective slump. They look lethargic. I know they're trying, but they look lethargic. And I think it's because the offense is so geared around the long ball and they just have nowhere to turn. So, Mike, what are your thoughts on that?
Oh, boy, Rich. I mean, we have to remember, you know, Coop has been the voice of reason so far. We're not even 10 games into the season yet. We all have to keep that in mind, myself included, because, you know, I'm no more innocent than the next person or guilty there of, you know, exaggerating things and taking things out of proportion. I mean, you know, if you look at the lineup, Granderson is leading off. He's not setting the table. I heard something disturbing about Neil Walker that perhaps he needed a day off, that his swing was getting a little long. You know, when I hear conditioning and major leaguers in the same sentence, it just makes me break out in a rash. Cespedes has been up numerous times of running against runners in scoring position, and he hasn't delivered yet. You know, we're expecting him to, but as of yet, no, he hasn't. David Wright, we still have our questions about him. And then Lucas Duda has just been living under the radar. He should just count his blessings. Nobody's talking about him, but I'm paying attention, and he's not doing much. He didn't do anything all spring, and he's yet to do anything to date. And then Travis d'Arnaud, you know, this is becoming an old story. He's not hitting, you know, and if I could say something that's not proper and self-conscious, I mean, he's not hitting well. You know, he's really sucking is what I'm really trying to say. It goes up and down the line. Eventually, we hope that when the weather heats up, you know, and becomes more consistent, that the hitting will become more consistent. So we knew what kind of team the Mets were for the first 4 months of last season without Cespedes, and we knew what they turned into over the final 2 months of the season with him. That's what I'm banking on. And right now, you know, the story is similar to last year. Good pitching, lack of hitting, and, you know, fundamentally a 500 team. So, obviously, Cespedes has to be a difference maker, you know, and we're still crossing our fingers with the unproven, Conforto, you know. Let's not, you know, place all our eggs in his basket, per se, because he was only a rookie, and this is, I believe he still has rookie status. Correct me if I'm wrong. And if not, well, he still has the sophomore jinx to contend with. But everyone, you know, needs to just relax. It seems like Asdrubal Cabrera is our best hitter at the moment and seems the most comfortable out there. And at least he's put us to ease at shortstop at the moment.
Yeah, so, right, so what I'm hearing you say is that there are a lot of guys in the lineup, a lot of guys who can contribute, and, you know, it is early, and you're right. And if any of them get going, any one of them can carry the team. It just, they're collectively slumping. So, Coop, what are your thoughts on the offense? I mean, are you concerned about it today? Are you concerned about the makeup? Or do you take more of the approach that, look, you look at the back of the baseball cards, here's a cliche for these guys, and you know what they're going to do, and we all need to chill. Where are you coming down on this?
I mean, again, I'm looking at it from the perspective that it's so early in the season. And, as we're talking and I'm listening to Mike talk, my perspective is, you know, we can look at the back of the baseball cards to see what type of player they are. But keep in mind, Rich, you and I did that for Jason Bay. We did that for Jason Bay way too long. But, you know, I don't see any Bay-like qualities on this team either. You know, talk about Travis d'Arnaud. Travis d'Arnaud also, it was weird. Last year, I vaguely remember him kind of getting hot and then he got hurt, right at the beginning of the season. You know, he's 27 years old. Michael Conforto, easily, you know, one of the best pure hitters on the team, he's 23. You know, these guys just aren't clicking on all cylinders yet. So I'm not terribly concerned. The games that they're losing, they're in them. You know, they save the game, you know, opening day against the Phillies. They had that one really huge inning. The rest of the time they lost very close games, with the exception of the Mets start, of course, versus the Marlins. We have a lot of young hitters that just haven't really kind of found their groove. Also, when I'm looking at some of the numbers here, they're not very sustainable. Take, for instance, Neil Walker. And, you know, Mike made a comment about his swing, and he might be trying to overcompensate. And I find that, and this may not be, you know, I follow the Mets the closest, obviously, than any other team. But, you know, they could be trying to adjust just to kind of get something going. That's not to say that he might, you know, maybe he's going to end up being the Jason Bay. I don't know. Neil Walker right now, his batting average and his OBP are identical. That's not going to happen. Longares hasn't, you know, really played all that much yet. You know, not nearly as, you know, he hasn't had nearly as many as that, let's say, Asdrubal Cabrera or, you know, Cespedes or even, you know, a Conforto or whatever. So that, you know, that's kind of unfair. You know, these numbers are going to level out. It's frustrating. I mean, a 1-0 loss in April is the same as a 1-0 loss in August. You know, you're still going to be like, you can't score a run. You know, but that's really a team thing. I mean, as far as I'm concerned, you know, the pitching's there. The hitting's going to come around, too. That's, you know, I don't want to say, I'm not concerned, but there's really not a player that I'm like, you know, maybe Granderson, you know, and Mike brought up a very, very, you know, pointed argument. He's our leadoff hitter, and he's hitting under the Mendoza line. Dude! No! You're not supposed to
do
that.
Yeah, it's not sustainable, right.
You know, get on base more, do something. So, you know, I have to believe that, you know, they're going to level it out. It's hard to say, but there's not really anybody that I'm like, oh, my God, this guy's a bust. You got to get rid of him. And you know I would say that.
Yeah, I know you're long enough to know that.
You know the real reason why everyone's pissed off. You know.
What's that?
We lost to the Phillies and the Marlins.
You have a point
yeah.
there.
Yeah. And,
well,
and
the Phillies can be better than people think.
I was going to say, you know, shameless plug is that Ed wrote a post on how the Mets have had an extraordinary amount of one-run games against the Marlins since Citi Field opened, and they're split in that. So, you know, out of all the one-run games, they're what, 29 and 29, babe? Yeah, they're 29 and 29 in one-run games. So that's a lot for those teams. So they kind of play to their level. But that, you know, Mike, that is also, I mean, but this isn't the Phillies with Rollins and Utley or Hamels or Victorino, who blocked me on Twitter, by the way.
It's like a medal you wear proudly around your neck, right?
Absolutely.
When you block on Twitter. All right, Long Island Mike, I know you've had some thoughts on the Mets offense. What are your thoughts at this point?
Before I start ranting, I just have a few things to say. Yoenis Cespedes, that camera work by SNY was horrible. I thought that was in the second. I thought that was in the second deck, but yeah, it got caught because of the wind. And then, and then for the offense, we just can't hit. They got to stop looking at called third strike. Swing the bat. That's the point of the game, isn't it? Or am I missing the point of the game?
Well, the point of the game, if you've read Moneyball, the point of the game in Sandy's mind is to get on base. And so that could mean swinging the bat or could mean, you know, not helping the pitcher out and drawing your walks. And sometimes the line between the two gets a little bit blurred. But I think collectively what I'm hearing is that everybody thinks, okay, you know what, yeah, they're not hitting, and they look terrible when they're not hitting, but they will. And then better times are ahead. And I think that's fair. I think when you look at the lineup that they have, you know, Coop, you made a really good point about Neil Walker. Here's a guy who is on base percentage is the same as his batting average. That will not persist. Granderson will not be a 100 hitter the rest of the season. He will get on base. He will draw his walks. And Cespedes is a 30 home run, 100 RBI guy, and he'll do that again. So it's just, you know, when they're not hitting, when you have that power-based approach and you're not hitting, you look lethargic because, you know, look at what D. Gordon does. If the Marlins aren't hitting, Gordon gets on, at least he steals second, maybe steals third. The team looks alive. It's just, it's a perception issue, but that's the way it goes when you can live and die with that long ball. So, all right, moving on to a couple more topics for tonight. So with regard to David Wright, now David Wright, the Rising Apple staff right before the season started did a day where we all picked a certain topic and we all commented about that. And one of the topics we picked was what can we expect from David Wright, because it is a big deal. David Wright is the third baseman on this team that is expected to go to the postseason. He's right now the second hitter. And I wanted to get your thoughts on what you're seeing from David Wright so far, beyond the numbers, you know, beyond his batting average and on-base percentage. What are you seeing with your own eyes? Are you seeing a guy who, yeah, you know, he's just getting a little older, but he's the same basic guy? Or are you seeing signs of concern because of his physical condition? So, Coop, let's start with you. I know you kind of have gone up and down with David over the years, but what are you observing in David Wright?
Well, right now, let me think. Davey is only 32 years old. And while, you know, we tend to think of the age 30 as being, you know, the cutoff, you know, there's always like the good side of 30 and then there's the bad side. And he's just getting into that. And, you know, obviously he had a rough year last year, spinal stenosis, blah, blah, blah. I feel like Davey, and you know, I call him Davey. It's my thing. We let it go. I feel like he might be just a little bit cautious this year, and the way that the team is treating him, you know, TC is giving him, you know, like every fifth day off, and he's giving him kind of like the Mike Piazza treatment, you know, Sundays off or whatever it is. I feel like, you know, the team is also kind of treating him with kid gloves. Steve Keen has a great saying about David Wright, and it's Tom Stevens not going to live forever. So we kind of have to protect this investment over time, but also, you know, kind of keep him, you know, at this, you know, kind of franchise-like level, because someday David is going to have that crown. That said, hold on one second. I need to consult with my research assistant, if you may. Ed, what were you saying about David Wright's 2000th hit, when that could potentially be? Okay. So sometime late next year, David Wright is probably going to hit a milestone of 2,000 hits. And what did you say about 3,000? He's not going to get there. 2,500 maybe. So he has, you know, he's obviously the hit leader with the Mets, and the only reason that the guy before him had it was longevity. I mean, David Wright, he's, you know, we're kind of protecting, you know, kind of protecting the family here. But what I see with him is that he is kind of willing to take a risk. He is willing, you know, he's always been a team guy. His numbers are probably going to level off. And right now, his BA is 280, OBP is 438. You're like, wow, but, you know that's not sustainable. But his slugging is 400, which, you know, it doesn't make a ton of sense when you look at those numbers together. You know, he's only had 25 at bats so far. So that said, you know, what am I seeing about David Wright? You know, he's kind of the elder statesman now, and we kind of have to look at him through that lens. You know what I mean? So that's just kind of my take on David Wright right now.
Hello.
Hello.
Hello. Rich?
Did we lose Rich?
Did we lose Rich? Oh, our first technical difficulty of the evening. Hello, folks. My name is Michael McCollin, and I'll jump in as your host this evening on the 129th episode of the Rising Alpha Report. We have with us this evening our featured guest, The Coop. And we also have Long Island Mike, who's a frequent caller of the show. I'll pick up where Coop left off. We were talking about David Wright. For the moment, at least, my dashboard looks like Rich is still connected.
I'm back, guys.
All right.
Oh, okay.
We have our host back. And that was Michael hosting the Rising Apple Report. Back to you, Rich.
I don't know what happened, and I apologize. For some reason, my phone went dead, but I don't know where we left off. Where did you guys leave off?
I was just about to pick up my own version of the David Wright story.
And, Go for it.
Coop is kind of right, man. You know, we're treating him like family. Pick your poison. Love is blind. You know, we look at him through orange-colored glasses. I can't help but think, and for those of you listening out there who aren't old enough, you know, there was a fellow named Don Mattingly who also was diagnosed with spinal stenosis. It took him years to find a comfort level. And what I mean by that, in the batter's box and on the field, and a lot of standing around. Baseball is a lot of standing around, and that hurts. And by the time he figured it out, it was too late. The Yankees moved on to Tino Martinez. But David Wright, tell me if I'm wrong. Did anyone get a sense of deja vu? I'm not sure if it was Wednesday's day game or the game prior. When he fielded a ball and he lollipopped that underhand throw to Lucas Duda, who in turn threw home and they nailed somebody at the plate. So you pick and choose the game in the moment. I'm just describing what I saw, because obviously it reminded, well, the first thing that jumped into my mind was the World Series, obviously. I see the same thing. He's still dealing with the same ailment. You know, so from October to April, I still see the same thing. So, again, pick your poison, love is blind, orange-colored glasses. He is David Wright, and we're not going to turn on him. And perhaps, like Yankee fans did with Don Mattingly, we're going to exercise the utmost patience until he seemingly figures it out. It took him years to get a comfort level in the batter's box. And maybe, I don't know, I'm not a doctor, I didn't stay in the Holiday Inn last night, maybe he'll figure it out. Maybe his pain will be alleviated to a point where he can perform at a somewhat higher level than Don Mattingly was able to. We don't know. We'll just have to wait and see. But that's the kind of treatment he's going to get. Then again, you know, there's a new generation, you know, of Mets fans out there who seems to have a stronger voice than us aging, fading fans. You know, and they say he who screams loudest gets heard. So, you know, they might turn on him. Would it surprise me? No, because that's what New Yorkers do now. So it wouldn't surprise me in the least bit if people turned on him should his performance take a nosedive. You know, but I think he's going to get the family treatment, as Coop said.
Interesting. And I think he does get it now. You know, I think and it will continue for a while. I think, everybody has a certain limit to patience, but let's look at it like this. Cespedes, I was in the ballpark Saturday night, and it was very cold. Cespedes was booed Saturday night in game six. Or no, game four. Cespedes was booed. He wasn't getting the family treatment. David Wright, maybe it's because of the injury, and it's probably more because he's David Wright, will continue to get a lot of slack from the Mets fans. That's probably not a bad thing. All right, Long Island Mike.
Hey,
we're getting a lot of noise in the background.
Rich,
I'm not sure if... Yeah. Go ahead.
Rich, I just wanted to point out that I don't know why Mets fans are surprised that other fans are booing Yoenis Cespedes six games into the season. Because this is the same fan base that booed Johan Santana's very first home start in 2008. So take that with a grain of salt. I'm not surprised, and keep in mind that you have all the Twitter armchair people saying, I never boo my own team, and it's like people didn't boo Oliver Perez or Luis Castillo. Somebody's flipping booing these people. I wouldn't boo Yoenis Cespedes. I'm not, the Yoenis Cespedes fangirl or anything, but I'm certainly not going to boo him six games into the freaking season. People.
We're a fickle bunch. We're a fickle bunch. He saved our season last year, and now we're booing him in game four. So, yeah, that's the way it goes, unfortunately. So, Long Island Mike, what are your thoughts on David Wright?
Before I get to my thoughts, I have a question. Do we have any, top prospects for third base or no?
Not that I'm aware of. I think Wilmer Flores is your depth at third base.
Man, Matt Reynolds, that's it. That's what you have right now.
Okay, so a suggestion for the Mets. Draft a third baseman in the draft when it comes to that. Just a suggestion,
Not a bad suggestion.
I don't keep up with college baseball, but all I'm saying is draft a good one.
Well, if we treat David like family, if we want to continue that analogy, you don't have family forever, and you have to cherish them while they're around, and maybe that's where we are with David. He might not be the player he was, and he's not going to be here forever, and who knows how much longer he does that, but let's enjoy him while he's still on the field. All right, so moving on to a couple of other Mets topics. Rafael Montero. I don't think we have a lot to talk about with Montero, but I did want to throw that out there. Rafael Montero was called up, and when we talk about Steven Matz and Zach Wheeler, how they're kind of under the radar now because of Thor and Harvey and DeGrom, talk about being under the radar. Rafael Montero is a guy who just a couple of years ago was thought of as the next big thing. Montero he was like a little Pedro, great pinpoint control, all that stuff, not a really big guy. In fact, I thought he was a lot like Pedro, to be honest, not nearly the success he had, but kind of physical makeup, way of going about pitching. And through a series of injuries and just underperformance, Montero just hasn't really been that guy. And so now he's on the team, and we're not quite sure what they're going to do with him. I don't really see a need for another starter. Long relief, maybe. Maybe they'll send him down shortly. But I just wanted to kind of throw it out there and see if anybody bites on Montero, if you have any particular thoughts on him. So, Mike, let's start with you on Rafael Montero.
I got a lot of thoughts on Rafael Montero, only because, the Brooklyn Cyclones play in my backyard. 2 years ago, the Mets utilized him as a starter in a handful of games last year, primarily in relief. what he'll do with the Mets right now in this scenario, I don't know how they will utilize him, and I don't know how effective he's going to be. In 2010, the Brooklyn Cyclones pitching staff, I mean, dominated. And I do mean dominated the New York Penn League. And Rafael Montero was part of that starting rotation, a rotation of five. And all five of them, I mean, were just stellar, Rich. Just, I mean, awesome. Collectively, as a team, the team fell a little short that year, but that pitching staff was awesome. Now, my point is, these prospects, it just goes to prove what an inexact science dealing with these prospects are. Because one by one, these guys are falling by the wayside and not making an impact on the major league level. As a matter of fact, one of them was released from the, not released, but in a transaction, I think he's on the Yankees now, Luis Sessa. He was part of that group of five. And Montero was one of them. And there's three others that are still toiling in the minor leagues. And here we are in 2016. So just to reiterate the point, you know, when you're dealing with these prospects, it's an inexact science and you just never know. You know, they reach a certain point and then the law of diminished returns takes over. And then, poof, they're out of Major League Baseball. So who knows? I hope all the best for Montero and his contributions as a Met and for us fans. Yeah, you know, obviously, but you just never know.
Coop, Rafael Montero, kind of flying under the radar, right? What are your thoughts?
He's flown under the radar so much that I really don't have a strong opinion on him. I mean, I'm sorry to say I probably should. But, like, I mean, we probably did hear his name, as Mike mentioned, we probably did hear his name several years ago because he did have such success with the Cyclones. And, you know, they're in Mike's backyard. Well, you know, we get to see them up close and personal, too, because they do happen to play within the same, you know, radius as the Mets do. You know, I mean, as far as what we're going to do with them, I really have no, and you know that I'm very strong in my opinions, I really don't have a strong opinion on Rafael Montero, unfortunately. Sorry to say. You know, hopefully they'll find a place for him. You know, but they've had, it seems like this is a repetitive problem that the Mets have had. Remember a couple years ago, Pedro Viato, they didn't really know what to do with him. And, like, I kind of get that vibe here, too. I don't know. I'm probably completely off there. But, you know, I'd be curious to hear what y'all think about him as well.
Well, Long Island Mike, what do you think of Rafael Montero?
I really don't have an opinion on him either. It's not that he's flying under the radar. I'm just so young that I really only know. I'm not like you guys so smart with it. I'm really not, and I don't want to give any wrong info or opinions, but, yeah, sorry.
Well, Montero's a guy who, as far as I'm concerned, if I were a GM of a team that needed some pitching, I'd want to see Montero on the major league level for a few starts or a few decent length appearances. And I might think going after him as kind of like a diamond in the rough kind of a guy, because you know he doesn't throw 95, 98 like Thor, like DeGrom, like Harvey. So, you know, he's not out of that ilk. He's more of a, you know, a precision control pitcher. And what that means is if his control is off on a given night, yeah, he's going to get pounded, and that's what happened to him in his – well, actually, his control was bad. He was walking people. And then when he was over the plate, he really can't pitch over the plate like the other guys can, and he was getting hit pretty hard. But I think Montero's trade bait for this team. I think he's been for a while. And as far as I'm concerned, I'd like to see the Mets use him on the major league level, let other teams get a look at him and see what they could get for him, because he clearly doesn't slot in here. That's my thought on Rafael Montero being up. I'm kind of glad he is, and I have nothing against the guy. It's not like I want him off the team. It's just I do see him as being more valuable to other teams than to the Mets. And so, you know, let's give him a chance to prove himself again and then maybe look to him as a trade team. That's my thought. All right, so as we start to turn the corner and wrap up episode 129, a couple more things I want to talk about. So we've talked about the pitching, we've talked about Harvey, we've talked about various other things.
let's just let the rubber hit the road here and talk about the 3-5 start. So as a Mets fan, you know, let's face it, we all have expectations this year. Some think World Series, wild card or division or whatever it might be. But is the 3-5 start, I have two questions, at all concerning to you? And if it is, in what way? So why don't we go to our guest first, and we'll go to Coop first and say, Coop, you know, you've watched this team for a long time. You've now watched 8 games. 3-5, to you, is it like, please, you know, talk to me in July when you played half the season? Or are you at all concerned?
It's funny that you say that because I probably it's said many times, and it sort of kind of started in the World Series last year. When the Mets went down, they were down 0-2, you know, coming to Citi Field for Game 3. All you kept hearing about was, well, in 86, the team lost, you know, the first 2 games, and then you know what happened there. And I got really irrationally angry about that. And I couldn't really pinpoint why. In one aspect, I was kind of mentally comparing the 2015 team and the 1986 year. I'm like, well, they're not even close. But that's not what people were doing. They were just kind of giving this little piece of, well, you know, history doesn't dictate that, you know, they're just going to lose all the games or they're going to lose the World Series. You know, there's still a potential that, you know, they could win the next 3 games. People were saying that, but I got really irrationally angry because, as most of the people on here know, I'm also a New York Rangers fan in hockey. And in 2014, they got to the Stanley Cup Final. And I remember telling somebody on the night of Game 1, they were like, how do you feel about tonight? And I said, well, you know, I said, if they lose, it's not the worst thing. And the way that I rationalized it was, you know, they don't have to be hot out of the gate. You know, it could be a hard-fought game, and they could lose. Unfortunately, the Rangers lost the first 2 games, and they came back to the Garden, you know, down 2 games. Now, what really got me angry about Mets fans using that analogy in the World Series was that I had seen this same exact scenario play out with the Rangers and the Kings in 2014, that these were very winnable games. And I had this irrational anger that it's like, why do we have to look at things in blue and orange-colored glasses? Let's call it for what it is. They played like shit. They should have won those games. And it becomes this, you know, overcrediting of the Royals and being like, Royal Devil Magic, blah, blah, blah. No, the Mets could have won those games, and that's what really infuriated me. So then, you know, this ties into the beginning of this season. Everybody and their fucking monkey's uncle has to come out and say, well, you know, the 1986 Mets started off 2-3. I'm like, I will shove my phone up somebody's ass if they say this one more freaking time. Because this doesn't, you know, the 1983 team started 2-3. This is not, you know, this isn't something that's going to calm me down. I also know that the Mets weren't going to go undefeated this season. You know what I mean? So, you know, on one hand, I got really irrationally angry looking at all these, you know, history dictating future performance kind of ideas. But by the same time, if I am one of these fans, like, you know, my research assistant over here, who's mentally calculating magic numbers and looking at, he even said, do you know my husband had the cojones to say to me earlier that the Mets are on track to be, what was it, 81 games out of first place? 81 games out of first place. I said, honey, you do realize that this is, like, completely unsustainable and that shit's just never going to happen. Like, that's never happened before in Major League Baseball, let alone any sport. And he's like, no, but it could happen. So I'm like, okay, you know, throw the probabilities out the window. Stop looking at it like, oh, my gosh, 3-5. They're going to suck for the rest of the season. Blah! It's April. Like, I'm not going to be dining my guts. I know that a loss or a win in April counts just as much as a loss or a win in September. But, you know, as I said in 2007, there were games in the middle of the season that the Mets should have won, and they didn't, and that was the difference. You know, it shouldn't have come down to that last weekend against the Marlins, but it did. So, you know, starting off the season, after that, you know, maybe it's a combination of post-traumatic Mets disorder. Maybe I'm just so numb that I'm like, whatever. You know, they could win the next 100 games. I don't really give a shit. But, you know, I'm not really going to stress out about the season. I know that was kind of a long-winded answer, but I really just had to get off my chest why this whole history dictating future performance really, really gets me angry.
Well, okay. And you know, it always makes me laugh when people say, when people compare teams, like, you know, like you were saying, you know, the 85 Mets did this, and the era was, that's 30 freaking years ago. I mean, the 85.
It has no bearing on them.
It has no bearing. And when people say, you know, no Met pitcher has ever done this, well, yeah, but those guys aren't relevant anymore. Let's talk about the present. It just, and I'm with you on that. The 2-3 thing with, you know, with the 86 team starting out 2-3, as if that somehow puts you on the fast track to the World Series, is just, it's just absolutely insane. So,
thank you.
Yeah.
Thank you.
Yeah, I'm with you on that. I'm totally with you on that one. If you think somehow 2-3 portends the World Series because the 86 team did it, yeah, then Santa will bring you a nice big bike under your Christmas tree this year. So,
cool.
Anyway, now that I've ranted about that, Mike, your thoughts on 2-3? Not a big deal. I'm sorry, I got 2-3 in the brain. Your thoughts on 3-5? Not a big deal. Are you concerned? Go for it.
I'll just continue your rant. You know, I mean, both of you are so right. That 86 team, that was a finished product. There was no improving that team. They had everything. You know, for those of you who remember, and for those of you who don't, we're here to tell you. These Mets are not those Mets. Far from it. This is still really an unfinished product compared to that. Anyway, a 3-5 start, Rich, with cover years, because you've heard me say this a million times on this podcast. Here we go. You can't win pennants in April, but you can lose them. That's my point. A 3-5 start, to me, no problem. I don't care about that. It's the month that concerns me. A sub-500 record in April would be disturbing for me. Not that, you know, that would be a prediction of doom and gloom for the rest of... No, it's just, that's not what we expect of this team now. So I'm more concerned about the overall month. I'm not worried about a 3-5 start. Although the Nationals are 7-1, you know, so you still have to keep an eye on, you know, on the scoreboard. It's early scoreboard watch, and there's nothing wrong with that. Just don't get carried away with it. They're 7-1. We just came off a series of losses to the Phillies and the Marlins, and that's not the way it's supposed to go. You know, those are the teams we're supposed to be beating up on. And, you know, the only reason why the Phillies are in second place right now and the Marlins are in third place right now is because they beat up. We'll get that turned around. You know, but a start like this, no, it doesn't bother me in the least bit, because for those of you who are old enough to remember, back in those years, 77, 78, 79, we were in first place throughout April numerous times, only, you know, to end up with, you know, 97, 98, and 99 losses, et cetera, et cetera. So it is what it is. Baseball is a numbers game, and that's why it's a long season, and that's why it gets figured out over the course of 162 games.
Long Island Mike, as a younger Mets fan who hasn't lived through 86, hasn't lived through the 70s where good starts, bad starts don't necessarily predict the outcome of the season. What are your thoughts on the Mets being 3-5?
The thing that concerns me is how writers are like, oh, it's early. Okay, they're going to save that one. It's June still, right? It's not early when the Nationals are going up 7-1 already. It's going to be a bit concerning because the time we finally start looking at the scoreboard, it's going to be a 10-game lead. That's why I say, okay, no, games. What was that? Take
yeah,
game by
ahead.
Game. Okay, I just want to make sure it was, I didn't lose connection. I just want to take game by game, look at the scoreboard, though, because the time when you finally do look at the scoreboard, it will be a 10-game difference, and that's what concerns me.
Yeah. Well, you know, I think Mike said it best, and I'm going to go with that. You can't really win the pennant in April. You know, if you go out in April and you go 15-6, you know, or something like that, that doesn't mean you've won the pennant. But if you go 6-15, you might have put yourself in a situation where you're in such a deep hole, depending upon how the competition did, that you could, in fact, lose the pennant in April. So it's not really a time to panic. It's not really a time to, in my opinion, do what Terry did and risk blowing out Jeurys Familia's arm and Jim Henderson's arm. over a game in April. It's not time to panic, but it's also being too cavalier about it is also not good. You know, as if to say, oh, it's a long season, no big deal. No, I mean, if you're seeing trends that are concerning in April, what if those trends continue? You know, if it is, the games in April mean something. That's the point. They mean something. And I think only a fool doesn't pay attention. So, all right, with that said, two more things to do tonight. The Cleveland series coming up. The Mets are going to be throwing Bartolo Colon, who goes back to from whence he came. He began his career in Cleveland in 1993, I believe. So Bartolo will be out there in game one for the Mets, and then followed by Matt Harvey, followed by Steven Matz. So I'm just going to ask you to tell me what's going to happen in the Cleveland series. Have a little fun with that. How do the Mets fare in Cleveland? We will start with you, Coop. Are the Mets going to sweep them, get swept? What's going to happen?
Well, I mean, I don't think we're gonna get swept. I definitely think, you know, I'm gonna go for it. I'm gonna say they're gonna win at least one game. I'm not gonna make any bold coup predictions. I don't even know who's starting for Cleveland. Does anybody know? Off the top of their head. I haven't even looked that far ahead. But I will say this.
Cody Anderson is starting for them tomorrow.
Okay. Because I know that they had, you know, 2 years ago they actually had the Cy Young Award winner, but he kind of fell off the cliff last year. But, you know, Cleveland's not a bad team. They're a decent team. Hopefully, you know, as Mike said, and that's something, you know, that I wasn't irrationally angry about. History dictating future performance, people, but I wasn't irrationally angry at the Mets losing series to the Phillies and the Marlins for some reason. I don't know why that is. But, you know, at least, you know, we can see the Mets kind of playing a team of their caliber, and they always seem to kind of rise to the occasion. It's always against the NLA teams that really want them to beat that they don't beat. So, you know, and then, you know, it's cute that we talk about, oh, Bartolo Colon's going home. Somebody actually just posted a picture. It might have been Maggie Wiggin who posted a picture of skinny Bartolo in Cleveland and Bartolo now. So there's, you know, quite a little bit of a change in dynamic there. So I think it's, you know, I think it's going to be a good, you know, mark my words, there will be good baseball. And, Rich, I would also like to point out that the last time the Mets were in Cleveland, the Spiragos and the Cooperleros went to support the Mets with that series.
That's right. We did the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame first and the ball game, and that's something I recommend to anyone. Go to Cleveland. It's a wonderful ballpark. The Rock and Roll Hall of Fame is right there. It's time well spent, and that was a very enjoyable couple of days.
Yep, it was.
Excellent. Yeah, it's strange to me. I thought about that today, Coop, and it's strange to me that usually when the Mets play an AL team other than the Yankees and they play them in their ballpark, 3 years later they play them at Citi and vice versa. It's weird the Mets are playing them the 3 years ago they played them in Cleveland, then this time around they're playing them again in Cleveland. It's usually they alternate home, but anyway. Kind of strange. I don't know why that happened like that. All right, Long Island Mike, we'll go to you second. What do you see happening in the Cleveland series?
Loss.
Sorry. Long Island Mike, I mean, you might embody the young Met fan more than anyone I've ever met. I mean, we need to cheer you up, man. What's going on? Why do you think they're going to get swept?
I went to that Marlins game that 1 year. What year was that now? The Jim Full season, where it came down to the wire against the Marlins. I went to that one game where we got blown out, and ever since then, yeah, no bueno.
Okay. Well, I think the Mets are going to take 2 out of 3. I see them winning this series. I really do. I see them winning the Harvey start and the Matt start. I'm not so confident in Bartolo tomorrow night, but we'll see what happens. All right, so 2 more things to do. And what we're going to do now is we like to take a look at Mets who have worn a uniform number that is pertinent to the podcast. So this is podcast number 129. Nobody's ever worn 129. So we'll look at Mets who have worn number 29. You know, and I'm looking at this list here, and it's kind of an interesting one to me. And I'm going to focus on all I'm going to ask you to do is just make a comment about one or two players who might have a certain place in your memory. I'm going to comment on a couple of these guys. So one of them is going to be Ken Singleton. Ken Singleton, for the reason being, when I was a young tot, I went to a sports awards dinner, and they sent a representative from all the local teams, and Ken Singleton was the Mets representative. And a few people I knew who ran the dinner pulled a few strings, and I got to sit next to Ken Singleton. I was 8 years old, and what a thrill that is for this guy to walk in, a guy I've been watching on TV for the past couple of years, sit down next to me for an entire dinner. So Ken Singleton definitely stands out to me as a number 29. And then I'll make one more comment about one more guy who wore 29, and that would be one of my all-time favorite Mets, and that's Dave Magadan. He's in my top 25, we'll call it. Dave Magadan, to me, was the heir – well, he was the heir apparent to Keith Hernandez, was the heir. And, you know, Magadan was a guy, classic, you know, singles hitter, guy who, you know, good contact hitter and solid around the bag. I was always a Dave Magadan fan. Just a solid ball player, not flashy, not spectacular, not a lot of power, but I was always a Dave Magadan fan. So those are my two comments on Mets to wear 29. Ken Singleton for my memories of my childhood, and Dave Magadan I always like. So now, Mike, let's go to you next on this one. Mets who have worn 29. Does anybody on this list stand out to you?
It's too many. It makes this so difficult. For whatever reason, I want to start with Octavio Dotel, who was, you know, a stellar performer for us in 1999. But my point is that he is the epitome. He's the reason why we can't get too attached to players based on 1 year's performance, especially rookies or sophomores. Because, you know, they're brilliant 1 year, and then poof, they never seem to regain that magic ever again. And he's one of those guys, because he was never really the same player ever again, you know, that he was in 99. I was looking, and another name struck me on this list, the same player. I'm not going to hunt for him now. But Mickey Lolich in 1976... I was still young, a very impressionable Mets fan, and he started to embody one, a lesson, and that things changed, because while I don't like, back then, players didn't really change teams much. You came to know and expect year in, year out, who was going to be there. And guys like Mickey Lolich, I knew his record back with the Detroit Tigers, and that he was come to the Mets. But I looked at my yearbook, and he was so fresh that the Mets didn't have a picture of him in a Mets uniform in his picture in a yearbook. And forgive me for putting it bluntly, it was the 1976 yearbook, and it was just a picture of a fat guy. And as perhaps a 10-year-old, an 11-year-old, you know, that just said, wow, my Mets are changing, man. I don't think I'm ready for this. Frank Viola was also on that list, and like I said, he's a AAA, and I think he has a lot to offer as far as, you know, how to get these guys' brains to work and give them, again, illumination into their craft. So I'll just leave it at that. I don't want to go on, although I can, and sometimes I usually do, but I'll leave it at that.
Good. Mickey Lolich. You know, I could never like Mickey Lolich. He had a terrible season in 76. I don't know the numbers in front of me, but it was awful.
Yeah, it was disappointing to me, man. And that's part of it. You're absolutely right.
And the reason the guy could have gone 25-2 and I wouldn't have liked him because he was traded for Rusty Staub. Rusty
exactly.
is in my top.
That's it, Rich.
Yeah, that was
criminal. It escaped me. And I couldn't spit that out, but that's exactly what I wanted to say. I was so pissed off that they traded Rusty Staub
for that
yeah.
guy. And you know, and I was as a little kid disliking this guy and insulting his physical appearance, which is not cool. But I was doing it because he came over for my man LeGrand Orange, and I just could not stand the sight of Mickey Lolich. So, all right, Coop, you must have some thoughts on Mets who have worn 29.
I do, actually. It's probably one of the most divisive Mets ever, Steve Traxel, who I happen to think on paper is one of the most underrated Mets pitchers that there ever were. You know, when he came over to the Mets in 2001, he would say, you know, he would kind of allude that he felt like the Mets were, you know, on the precipice. And in 2001, of course, they had gone to the World Series. He thought, you know, they were going to be contenders year in, year out. And then we know what happened. The Mets did a mess. And, you know, 2001 became like this downward spiral, but it led us to, you know, 2005 and the quote-unquote new Mets. And all of a sudden, Steve Traxel was kind of pushed to the back, whereas, you know, he was more of like a top-of-the-line starter, which is unfortunate because he's not. He's more like a middle-to-the-back-of-the-rotation kind of guy. He would give you innings. He would give you, but, you know, he was slow. We called him the human rain delay. He was horrible in that respect. You knew that his starts would be like 9 hours long. I mean, they were just horrible to sit through. But I always felt like he got a bum rap because, as you know, Rich set the tone earlier in the show here about how, you know, you have to make chicken salad out of chicken shit. That was what we were expecting with Steve Traxel. It was just unfair. He was the type of guy who would give you innings. He wouldn't give up many runs if he just wasn't getting run support. Then 2006 came, and we all know how 2006 was. But then he didn't show up when the team needed him most. There were rumors that his wife left him or his wife was cheating on him and he was going to attend to some family issues. Right when, you know, and he pitched the NL East clinching game, which I felt was very, that was kind of my, you know, like, bragging point. Like, I supported this guy since day one, and he is the pitcher of record in the clinching game. This is awesome. And then when it came to the postseason, you know, they had to fake an injury and pull him out of the game because he was just so ineffective. It was, you know, on one hand, it was really upsetting to me that he really couldn't finish what he started because he had even said he had hoped to have been in that position in the playoffs, in the postseason with the Mets the entire time he was there. But when it came time for him to step up and do his job, he couldn't. And that has left a sour taste in my mouth. But, you know, we all know that I suffer from PTSD. I suffer from post-traumatic mess disorder. This is just part of it. That's my 29 story.
Steve Traxel, unbeknownst to him, has given our friend Coop PTMD. I mean, is he proud
he's
of himself?
Part of it.
Look what
he's
you've done,
part of it.
Steve Traxel.
Go
I'm
in the
sorry,
corner.
Coop.
Sit in the corner.
That's right. Go in the corner and don't turn around until I tell you you can.
Yeah. You need a timeout. Take your juice box with you.
Long Island Mike, number 29 on the Mets. Does anybody in that list mean anything to you?
In a bad way, yes. You should know who I'm going to. Ike Davis. We all know the story on him. He sucks. Why did we ever get him in the first place? He sucks. That's my story. He sucks.
They got him because they drafted him. Long Island Mike, you're very funny tonight. They drafted him, and you know, he actually, when he came up, he was a whiz around the bag with the glove. He was, in my opinion, sure to be a Gold Glove winner, and he never actually did. And with the stick, you know, you knew he had a long swing, and he was kind of all or nothing, and you accepted him for that. But yeah, he fell out of favor pretty quickly. And it's unfortunate with Ike because he can bring something to the table. He can hit the ball at the ballpark, and he's very good defensively. And I do believe he's in the Yankee organization right now. So
he is. I thought he was in the Pirates.
I thought he was with the Texas.
With the Pirates.
Wasn't he with the Rangers? Texas Rangers.
He was traded to the Pirates.
He was with the A's last year, and he became a free agent. I believe he's injured right now. He's in the Texas Rangers system.
Oh, good.
That whole thing right there just demonstrated how inconsequential he has become.
That's true.
It's sad. I would just like to interject because I happen to be a huge Ike Davis fangirl back in the day. But if you remember, he wasn't ever the same after his quote-unquote Valley Fever, and I know a lot of people kind of thumbed their nose and poo-pooed it, like, oh, it was an excuse. My understanding with Valley Fever is that it manifests as like a mononucleosis, that, you know, you're incredibly tired and fatigued. And when you're a professional athlete, that really takes a toll on you. I mean, hell, I had mono when I was 17 years old, and I'm 40 now, and I still have moments where I'm like, oh, my gosh, I feel like I did when I had mono, because I get headaches now, I get migraines as a result of it, you know, not to go into my health history, but, you know, this is something that I think we have to consider with Ike Davis kind of falling off the cliff, is that he really hasn't been the same. People point to David Wright, and as we said earlier in the show, we're protecting our family, we're protecting our investment. You know, it's like, you know, you don't talk bad about the family. You know, it's like, Fredo, you disappointed me. You know, you don't go against the family ever, and that's what we're like with David Wright. David Wright really wasn't the same after he got hit by a pitch by Matt Cain. With Ike Davis, his physical ailments came internally, and I think we might have been a little less forgiving about him. But like Rich said, he was really like an all or nothing. He was like a home run strikeout artist. But, you know, that's kind of like Adam Dunn in a way, because he was like an Adam Dunn light. I don't think any one of us on this phone, Adam Dunn in his heyday, we would have turned him away. So the coup has spoken.
Ike Davis,
can I ask a quick question?
Sure.
Sure.
This is in the past. He's my favorite Mets player. What do you think, Carlos Beltran, on Hall of Famer or no? And does he go in as a Mets just yet?
Oh, that's a good question. Anybody want to take that?
I'll take a crack at it.
He had his career seasons with the Mets. I can say that. Hall of Fame, I don't know anymore. I used to be certain about what a Hall of Famer or what constituted a Hall of Famer. I'm not sure anymore. The whole thing has become convoluted for me.
I'm going to say this about Carlos Beltran. I love Carlos Beltran, by the way. I'm going to say very good player, falls short of Hall of Fame. I hope he makes it, but I say he falls short. And if he were to make it, I say he goes in as a Royal. Even though he had a shorter time as a Met, better seasons, but more time as a Royal. So I would say that's my thought. Coop, how about you?
I was very hard on Carlos Beltran when he first came to the Mets. By the end of his time, I loved him. I was a big-time Carlos Beltran fan. I unfortunately do think he's going to be Hall of Very Good. You would be surprised the conversations that center around baseball in my household most of the time. We talk a lot about Adrian Beltre, and my husband is literally obsessed with Adrian Beltre, and Carlos Beltran are two names that get kicked around. You know, we feel like Adrian Beltre is a definite Hall of Famer. I think he's a first ballot, in my opinion. Carlos Beltran, on the other hand, he's like Beltre light. I think he's going to end up Hall of Very Good. He might even be like that Tim Raines kind of quality, like the guy who kind of hangs on each year, gets enough to stay on the ballot. And then in his last year, they're kind of have to be like, okay, you know, is this guy Hall of Famer? He might get in on like that kind of technicality. It's hard to say whether he would go in as a Met just because of his injury history. It's weird because I look at, you know, the amount of games that he played as a Met, and there were 2 years that he, you know, barely had half of a season. And, you know, even though he had a postseason run with the Mets, he did have MVP numbers. You know, he probably would go in as a Royal just because. But I don't know. I mean, that is a tough question, and I think you could argue both sides of it. But, you know, in my opinion, I think ultimately he would be just, you know, a Hall of Very Good, you know, player at the end of it.
Agreed. From my perspective, agreed. All right, by my clock here, we have about a minute. So please just give us a minute or two more than that. So it's time for the last word. We're going to go guests first. We're going to go Long Island Mike first, Coop second, and then Mike will wrap it up. So 8 games in, Mets are 3-5. Terry's managing like his job's on the line. He's blowing out pitchers, all these kinds of things going on. Mike, what's your last word? Long Island Mike, what's your last word for tonight?
I totally agree with what he did the other night. He did nothing wrong. And Kevin Long better start telling the hitters to actually swing the bat and don't look at strikes.
No more window shopping, says Long Island Mike. I like it. Coop, what's your last word tonight?
My last word is just, you know, Curtis Granderson, get on base more, start setting the table, and we're going to see, you know, and start setting the table, not just as, you know, the leadoff hitter in the lineup. Let's set the trend for, you know, the other guys who are leading off in the next inning. Let's start getting on base more. And then, you know, we'll start seeing some stuff happen on the base path. I've got no worries. The pitching will cure the ills, but, you know, the offense will just come around. We just need to be patient.
Coop has the optimistic look. I like it. Mike LeColin, what's your last word tonight, sir?
Oh, boy. Congratulations to Jacob DeGrom and his wife on the birth of their new bouncing baby boy.
Yeah.
That and... Rich, you've heard it. Coop, you haven't yet. I'm using a portion of every podcast in my final word to say it's high time the Mets erect a memorial to Joan Payson at Citi Field.
Yes. I will get behind that one.
Nice. And with
they
that,
started it.
Yeah. Well, Mike, I know you're passionate about this topic, and I can go for that as long as we have one of Seaver and Staub as well. Staub does so much work in the community, and Seaver, of course, is the franchise. So Payson, Staub, and Seaver, do we have consensus?
Yep.
Agree for as long as it's in that order. Nothing happens without Joan Payson.
Absolutely. All right, we are out of time, and I want to thank you, Coop, for coming on tonight. It's always a pleasure having you on. Thank you very much for talking Mets with us tonight.
Yeah, love talking Mets with you guys anytime.
Long Island Mike, as always, thanks for calling in.
No problem.
And Mr. Mike LeColin, my esteemed colleague on the Rising Apple site, thank you for your contributions, as always, to the Rising Apple podcast.
The pleasure is always mine to be with you, Rich, and speaking with all our fans. Thank you.
Excellent. Good night, everybody, and let's go Mets.
Woo.
Let's go Mets.